America, you were never beautiful in the way we used to sing about in school. You built walls like wars, fragmented and fractured. You divided children with chain-link fences that should surround the schools that we can easily grant them access to, not mock the distances they've traveled and trauma they sustained.
Welcome, everybody. This is Sharon Smith, and we are on I Am Big Podcast, and I am here with my guest, the one that is, I call, also a Stockton native that moved up here, crazy as it is. I'd like to give y'all a little shout-out to a person I'm interested in, Nina Lorese. How you doing?
Doing okay.
Doing okay?
Yeah.
She's going to be having a feature here on February 3rd, coming up soon with Lynn Germanara. I'm bringing her in to give her in-depth review of what she's about, who she is, just to y'all people, because even, just like you, I'm going to be curious about just finding out more and more information. She has a lot of stuff on the line. But why don't we talk to her and let her speak about it? So, Nina, I got you into poetry. Seriously. Because you got a list of work.
Yeah, I feel like for a lot of poets and writers in general, it's kind of a similar story. But for me personally, it was sort of as a path towards healing.
Oh.
I started writing as a child. And in some ways, it was kind of a legacy scenario because my mother was also a writer and a poet.
Right.
And I lost my mother when I was 11 years old to breast cancer. And so for me, it was sort of like when I was still religious, it was poetry / prayers. And then it sort of just became a way to vent and to make sense of the world around me as a young child. And I just never let it go.
Oh, okay. Reading your poems and stuff about your mom, I didn't know she died from breast cancer. Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry for your loss. But no. Looking at that, I noticed that did you graduate from University of Central Florida in
I did.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was originally from Florida up until 2011. I came over to California, and so I'm currently still in school. I'm kind of a schoolaholic.
Okay.
So I've graduated from UOP as well, and I'm back in school in UOP again. So.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. What are you getting?
I'm getting, I have two masters, and I'm actually going back for in PhD studies in this case for educational and organizational leadership.
Oh.
So yeah, I'm kind of obsessed with school. It's kind of been my thing.
Okay. And you say you were an educator. So are you,
yes.
Are you teaching it?
Yeah.
School, whereabouts?
Well, currently, because I went back to school and I have three young children, I am part-time with a great organization here locally, 916 Inc.
Oh, okay.
I'm a facilitator for them and have assisted with some curriculum development and things like that. But previous to that, I was teaching English.
Oh,
so
okay.
9th through 12th and some college level English.
Oh, okay. Nice. Okay. Mm-hmm. I know 916 Inc. They're very good. Yeah. I'm glad that you're on the list with them on their employment. So with that in mind, you published in University of Central Florida, and then also you also published in Valencia.
Mm-hmm.
And have you published in like UOP's?
No, I haven't. I didn't really become that invested. I did do a few open mics that they had in Stockton when I was over there. They had a great open mic that they were doing for a while over there. I don't know if you have ever attended with students there, but I hadn't really reached out to the literary community too much in UOP, but it's okay. A goal for certain.
Okay. So being that did you move from Florida to California, or did you like have like other stops along the way and stuff?
No, Florida to California, from Orlando, Florida area to Stockton.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then to more recently, Sacramento. Yeah. Yeah. I had never heard of Stockton before moving over here.
You and me both when I first got there. I just knew when I moved up there, I was like, where the heck are we?
This
is Stockton. Like, no, this ain't California the way I think in California. Because I'm originally from Southern California. And then
okay.
I moved up from Southern California, Northern California when I was 13.
Oh, okay.
So I got my awareness living in the barrier for about 5-7 years. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to the military, and then I came back into my parents' where I moved to Stockton.
Okay.
So that's how I got dropped into Stockton, mm-hmm. mostly Stockton, Lodi area and stuff. So
got it.
So I lived in both areas for a while.
And I think what's interesting about Stockton, having taught there and been a part of the writing community a little bit, was that there's such a richness and there's such an interesting perspective throughout. And I think it sort of gets this bad name, and no doubt that there has historically been issues of violence and murder rates and things of that nature, and poverty and cyclical poverty. However, there is definitely a culture that is, I feel like, resilient. Mm. And has a lot to say. While I was there, I started this. We had this at Langston Hughes Academy where I taught. We had a spoken word group and a kind of like a slam poet team called No Dreams Deferred, which I coached for a little while. And that was a lot of fun. And they even had some connections with the poet laureate there, Tama Brisbane, who's amazing to work with. She has youth that she works with. With your words series, and it's incredible the work that she's still doing there actively, and just the voices of students there, which is kind of mind-blowing. They sort of have this wisdom beyond their years.
Speaking of, because there was a Stock native who slammed with you, mm-hmm. That's Brandon Lee.
Yes.
Brandon is from Stockton also. So it's just funny seeing he's still currently living there, and he actually bought a home there now.
Oh, that's
so
awesome.
So it's interesting how he's stabled himself in to Stockton.
Right.
He's cemented himself in.
Right.
Where a lot of us, like you and me, we moved away from that, mm-hmm. and moved to Sacramento, mm-hmm. and living our weird Sacramento life, but
right.
it's still home. I mean, I still call it sometimes home. I mean, heck, I graduated from Delta High,
okay.
College, so
yeah,
I know
for certain.
I mean, right next door to those two malls,
right? Yeah, yeah.
But speaking of which, what do you think about the scene itself? I was brought up in the scene in 2005 when Anywhere Cafe, well, actually 2003. When Anywhere Cafe started flourishing over by off Lincoln, right across from Lincoln, there was a poetry slam crew called H2O Poetry Slam.
Okay.
That started, and it was like open for like 2 years and stuff. And I got real accustomed with them for a while and started dropping, well, beyond rhymes, but poems and stuff with them and stuff. And they showed me how slam formulated from their side. So it's interesting when I hear, I didn't think of anybody in slam that lived in Stockton. I was just thinking mostly it was a music town. So I was mostly, rhymes and DJing and stuff with a band and stuff. So when I hear people say, yeah, there was a popping scene. Only thing I knew where our scene was over in Modesto, over at the Queen Bean.
Right. Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah. And most of the time I always go to Modesto and Queen Bean. And I was like, I see a few poets, I see a few MCs and stuff. And I was like, okay, there's a thing here, not over in Stockton. And I'm like, okay, so I got to go to Modesto to hang with those guys and stuff. So I did see that you did showcase at the Queen Bean.
Yeah,
stuff.
I did.
So how was that?
It was an amazing experience. It had been a while at that time because I used to, feature in like Central Florida. And I sort of like once I went back to school and was teaching full time and was focusing on my children, I sort of, was more of a mother than an individual. And I think that there was this point in my life where writing was important to me, and sharing writing and hearing it, maybe more even so than sharing it, was just essential. And so I began reading and was asked by the host at the time, Summer Craft, and is now hosted by Al Melchor, who's also part of like the Stockton and Modesto poetry scene. Yeah. And so just a feature. And so then that was a great experience. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And since then, were you in that, where did you feel accustomed that you're starting to get into the scene with it and stuff? Like, because I know a lot of poets, like here, a lot of poets, you can find one left and right. They're like, oh, there's a poet right there. Where there, I had to really search. It looks like a little hard. Like, I got to search for y'all. Where are y'all at?
Oh, as far as like finding them, yeah, and things like that?
They weren't like next door to me all the time.
Oh, they're okay, very hidden. Okay. Yeah, I guess it's maybe because a lot of people travel to that area. It sort of just became like a hub, it seemed like, because there were events, as you mentioned, in Stockton, but I think they were kind of far and few between at times. Impressa was a coffee house that was popular for a while, but there would be open mics and sometimes there wouldn't be. So I think Modesto had more of a consistency, and also with Sam Pierstorf, who had slams and things like that going on, like the slam on Rye. And I think that there was just, and also, you know, Stella Baraltis, who's the poet laureate of Modesto, they were just kind of sort of infused. And so I would love to, for there to be, and it seems like there is, I just haven't been a part of it yet, like find the queen bean of, you know, Sacramento. And it seems like maybe Luna's Cafe, maybe the Sacramento Poetry Center is that. So I'm just sort of, you know, becoming acquainted with the poetry scene here.
Okay. Good. Yeah. And speaking of which, you came into my radar. Let's make this real.
Okay.
You came into my radar coming to my Hot Poetry in the Park show.
Yes.
And I thought that was interesting because I was like, oh, this is a new person. Mm-hmm. And just your poem that you did there, I have recorded it and stuff, but it's funny. See, when you did your poem, I was like, Where are you from? And I was like, I'm Stockton. Where in Stockton are you from?
Right.
Me, I've been in Stockton. I lived in the areas. And I'm like, I have never seen you.
Right. I'm elusive.
So finding you live up here and stuff, I'm bringing you in all the time. But I was like, how are you enjoying the scene so far? I mean, seeing that there's more than what you expected. It's like, oh, okay.
Well, I really love the slam that you hosted recently. I thought that was amazing. It had been a while since I've been a part of, and I think that you and even Len noted it during the presentation, where everyone was so warm with each other.
Yeah.
You know, there was such a love and a light, even with complete strangers. And, you know, I entered the slam. It wasn't my intention to win. I know I'm out of practice, and I'm not a performance poet per se. I'm more of a, you know, I'm really strong in writing, but I have stage fright. So that's always an, oh, yeah, for certain, anxiety, all that. Yeah. So for me, it's always a challenge to go through that way, but I still love it. So I kind of, you know, keep coming back.
Okay.
But with the slam itself, just to stand on stage in the presence of that type of talent was absolutely, you know, sensational. It was an amazing experience.
Okay.
Yeah. Uplifting, to say the least.
Because I did have the question where, how you feel more comfortable on the page or the stage? And you feel more comfortable on the page?
For certain. But my goal in this whole, like, 2020 is to, like, kind of just walk into fear, you know, whatever that means. And for me, it might be being a slam poet who has stage fright and just continually staying, you know, standing there. Usually it's the first poem that's, like, really unnerving. And once you get, especially if you're featured, once you get through one or two, then usually I feel pretty comfortable. It's just that initial getting up there and standing and being present.
Selectively homeless, of the emancipated variety. The combination of my father's meth-infused rages laced with heroin-induced comas fostered an overdose of disillusionment, and at 14, I left home. The odds are stacked and statistics dire. As little as 2% of displaced youth earns a degree. We have three times the amount of emotional behavior disorders.
I see that was what we call the old butterflies in the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
Feel.
Yeah.
And then after that, you're just kind of comfortable. Like, okay, let's do this.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Okay. And so we already talked about living in San Joaquin and stuff and the poetry scene out there. And it's still flourishing.
I mean, right.
As much as I've been up here, there's always something going on. And I'm like, why were y'all when I was down there? But I did notice that you did make the book.
Activistic. Yeah.
In 2012.
Yes.
And, it's from CHB Media. Mm-hmm. And is that your first book?
It is. It's my first, you know, book in print. It was something it's poetry from like a span of from being 15 years old to like 25 years old. And it was sort of just a collection I put together with CHB Media in Central Florida. And that sort of came out of being a frequent poet at Austin's Coffee, which is in Winter Park, Florida. And just sort of connecting with somebody who's interested in publishing my work there. And where I'm at right now, it's funny, as you look back, you like look at the stuff you've published and you're like, oh, I'd want to change so many things. But with my new collection, Chronicles of a Broken Childhood, working title and works, I think I'm focusing more on looking outside of myself you know, okay. Where it's, yes, poetry is introspective, but also talking about issues beyond just, you know, anxiety and depression. Those are important, but also just issues of like gun control.
I can't pinpoint the exact moment I found gun ownership puzzling. It may have been at 11, when I regularly negotiated with my father to put the loaded revolver away, as he mourned my mother's loss to that Scorpions album on repeat. I cannot pinpoint the exact moment I found gun ownership corrupt. It could have been the moment my two-year-old niece pointed a gun in my direction.
And immigration crises, and how do you sort of talk about that without being too soapboxy? And that's kind of like where I'm at right now. So
I did like with your when reading your about, you said soapboxy. I'm like, yeah. Oh, okay. Think about that. It's like, but anxiety ridden. I was like, oh, mm-hmm. Okay. I know.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
But I was also pointing out on, I see on the book that it has several other people like from cover design and mm-hmm. and that you, it seemed like it was a family, a lot of family members got contributed to mm-hmm. helping you out with the book itself. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering like the cover art and stuff mm-hmm. and also the photos and everything. I did notice that in the book you had a lot of celebrity quotes.
Yeah.
And that was very interesting. I bought the book. Sorry. Oh. I read the whole thing. I
appreciate it. No problem. With, my little brother actually is very artistic. So he painted the cover design, which was like just a lake where we grew up in Central Florida. And that's what the cover is his artwork, and the photography is my sister, my older sister. And so, yeah, I did reach out to them because I saw that they're more artistic, you know, visually, where I'm more written work. Mm-hmm. I don't really have that talent, or as my husband says, I just haven't practiced that talent. Oh, okay. But yeah, so it was meaningful because with that book too, this book was kind of like, if anyone's ever had like an estranged father and they've wrote letters to them but never had like the guts to send them that letter, like this book was that letter. And I did mail it to him and he was quite angry, but it was okay because I felt like even though the book, I don't think you would view, I saw your face, like as raw or you know, overly gritty, it was open about, you know, the addictions and dysfunction that I had grown up around. And I think that that's just difficult for anyone to, you know, kind of face head on. And so for my father, that was that book. It was, you know, for me, it was sort of, it's hard to describe. It was sort of like, I tried to describe it in the most authentic and honest way possible,
okay.
You know, without being unfair.
Yeah.
Because I think oftentimes with a dysfunction, it's unfair. Like this person did this or this abuse took place, but not looking at the whole picture of what that person had gone through as well. And so with the book, it was trying to, I think, it talked about like, you know, just the cycles of dysfunction and sort of breaking those. And I think a lot of what I write is about that is trauma-informed and resilience sort of based about resiliency.
I saw on the first page, mm-hmm. you did point out in the book, you have your disclaimer talking mm-hmm. about this is not about this. It's not about my alcoholism. This is not about abuse. It's not. Mm-hmm. You basically pointed out all the things of not all about my mom. You right. basically are just saying this is just stuff I just need to write and put it uh-huh. into a way. So what my concern was when I read that and I saw that, it's like, okay, are your poems supposed to be viewed not for traumatic proportion, or are they just supposed to be reviewed as this happened, this is how I felt about it, move on? Is it just something like they do a diaries and stuff? Just...
I don't know that it would be move on, I think, but I do like that you caught that. There was a line that said this isn't about alcoholism or abuse, but the overcoming of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so maybe not in the same tone of get over it, but that this occurred.
Yeah.
You know, this occurred and there's space for that, that it wasn't an illusion. It wasn't it can't be rewritten by what others might prefer to perceive the past in a different light, a distorted light. You know, I feel like a lot of times, especially and in just recently coming back from Florida, there's definitely like, yeah, I may as well have been in a different country, really. It's a different world there.
Yes.
And in ways I love it. And in other ways, it sort of shows that there's sort of like this acceptance of dysfunction, I think, there. And it's kind of covered up like we're just having a good time. But there's another side. And I think I might read a poem that I recently wrote about that experience called Florida is a Fever Dream, but we can get into that later.
I got family in Florida. Okay. So up in Jacksonville.
Oh, okay. I know that area.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's always funny to me when I look at Jacksonville, and then my dad used to live in Tampa.
Yeah.
It's funny how Jacksonville is trying to be more like Georgia, where everything yes. Tampa and stuff is like, you know, we're this way.
For the Californians out there, North Florida is South Georgia.
Yes.
So we don't, it's a different state. Yeah. But there's also this beautiful, like, just so many different cultures that I miss, you know, going out and like dancing with friends and just, you know, just the tropical food and Caribbean food. I miss so much that you just don't like get out here, like traditional Cuban sandwiches and things like that. Like just like food from the Bahamas and food from Haiti. It's just like, I was like, oh man, I haven't had any of that in like 7 years. So that was nice.
Dang. Yeah. I'm sorry, missing that song.
Yeah. I'm missing Tampa now.
It's Tampa life. But so reading the book and stuff, I was intrigued with some of the poems, like mm-hmm. The Missing. Mm-hmm. Who is Kipper?
Okay. It's interesting that poem stood out. Kipper was this boy. You know how you get these like advertisements in the mail and they'll say missing child on the back and they'll say age progression from like 20, 30, 50 years ago. And there was a boy named Kipper who he was actually a missing child and they were still looking for him. And it had been 40 to 50 years. I'll have to even go back because it's been a while since I've read that poem and read the article. But like who his mother was and how she was still holding out hope that she was going to find him, you know, after all that time, like she must be elderly now, but she's still like that bond, that motherly bond that she's still looking for him. And she's hopeful that he might be out there somewhere. I just found that like overwhelming. It was one of those things that you just look at and you didn't expect, you know, for it to call, you know, call attention to you, but just that a child being missing for that long and the parents still searching for him. And I just found that very heartfelt and kind of like touching, I guess.
Okay. And then the second poem I was interested in was Every Member in the Audience.
Okay.
And I saw it as an eye opener basically because it talked about the healthcare system.
Right.
And also talked about that you used to be an insurance agent.
Right.
That was so what would you like to say to the people about, because you basically at the end of that, you basically were like telling them, read the bylines, read everything in that thing, because they are not telling you everything what they say. They read what's in that the paperwork. What were you aware of? Because I saw you put the website too, just to make sure.
This was before quote unquote Obamacare or the ACA was, you know, passed, and I was really grateful for that bill. And I think what people don't understand is if you have a medical condition like cancer, like anything really, diabetes, even common things, it's getting coverage is nearly impossible. Insurance companies don't want to cover that risk, or they'll place an exclusion on it saying we'll cover you for everything but said condition, which is what you might need the most care for. So if somebody has been diagnosed with like major depressive disorder, they need care for that, they need maybe medication for that and therapy. A lot of insurance companies before quote-unquote Obamacare was put into law and enacted were allowed to say, okay, we'll cover you for everything but that, or we won't cover you at all. So what resulted, and when I was working in healthcare industry, was that a lot of people just couldn't get the care they needed. And you know, you're even talking about children who had cancer and needed treatments, and if they didn't qualify for different Medicare and Medicaid programs, or here we call it Medi-Cal, but the system, albeit imperfect in California, is in other states, it's so lacking. There's a lot of uninsured people. And for me personally, with, like I mentioned, my mother's passing and death, a lot of that was from her not having health insurance coverage. And so if you grow up in poverty, you know, just your life expectancy and just the reality of that, of the fact that like my mother could still very well be alive had she had access to insurance coverage. You know, it's, I think people should talk more about that. And when I worked in insurance, in fact, like a lot of it sort of became like, I don't know, I think like her experience lived through me. And so if anyone was missing coverage or was excluded, I would, you know, try to get them reinsured or covered again and things like that. So it was something I'm passionate about. I think that we can't just leave things to businesses, because businesses will always put profit above well-being.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's funny that you said that, because there are some other titles I read, like Economic Escape.
Mm-hmm.
And I read that one. And also, I believe it's called, I don't think it's called, I Want My Childhood Back, but I think, but it does point out about, I didn't come, one line you put in it was, I didn't come here for the lawnmower. I came here because I want my childhood back. And I was like, I know how that feels.
Yeah.
I know how that feels.
Yeah.
Where you just trying to get everything, what you suspect you should be getting. And it, I ain't gonna lie, it touched me because I know that feeling when you lost something, you know, you see people who have, you know, these wondrous childhoods or this wondrous life. So you're looking around like, what the hell happened to mine?
Right.
And
yeah.
Trying to reclaim. And you can't, and you try to ask the people who raised you, and then they looking at you like, what do you want? What do you think I want?
Yeah.
It's just funny to me reading about your book and seeing things like, you know, like, I want my childhood back, economic escape. There's a lot of stuff that you brought into poverty. You brought in some angst with your mom and some angst with your dad and stuff. And but it also comes down to the end of, this is, I also went to the beach. I stood there. I sunk in the water for a little bit. I came back up, and the kids were running in. I was like, oh, yeah, I can see that. You know, there's some memories of childhood memories. Like, yeah.
Right.
So I enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I was trying to remember, that poem was from a long, long time ago, Landscape of My Childhood. And that was another one of those compilations of, you know, all the things you wanted to say to, you repressed, perhaps, to a parent or guardian that didn't do right by you, perhaps, and you wanted to say, but you sort of bottled up because you thought that person might not hear you or might interrupt. And so the beauty of poetry is that they can't interrupt your piece, right? And so you get to stand up here and say it fully and truly. And that was one of those poems. I remember reading that aloud in, at Impresso in Stockton. And it's one of those things where people that are complete strangers just like come up to you shaking and crying and hug you because they connect to it so much. And I think that that was where I was like, wow, you know, at first it's uncomfortable and then you just feel so fulfilled, like, oh, somebody else understands me in that same way, or I've touched that person. And I think that's what I really truly love about spoken word, is just being an audience member and hearing the struggles and the honesty and the rawness that poets, you know, portray when they're up, you know, standing up here, is just, you know, I don't know. It's everything, I guess.
This brings you all together and stuff.
Right.
So you are working on a new book, Chronicles of the Broken Childhood. But I also saw in crimeset.org said you also had two other books. I was wondering about those too. Just basic titles, or are they also in the process? The Sea Also Rise and also Maternity Leave.
So on Maternity Leave, When Anxiety Meets Silence has kind of just been, it's sort of been, I think I'm going to pull what I had from that into Chronicles of a Broken Childhood. I didn't come up with a title because I feel like in some ways the title sounds a little negative, but then I also feel like my target audience are people who have had perhaps a dysfunctional past and are looking for a path towards resilience and, you know, just like finding that a different perspective and that it's not all bad, you know. Our experiences bring us perspective. And The Sea Also Rises is a piece of fiction. It's a novel I began about halfway through. I need to revisit it, honestly. The poetry is more at my forefront. But with fiction, it's sort of just, you know, it's just a different genre that I always wanted to finish, you know, a full novel. I think so many writers, we start so many of them and, you know, they never go anywhere. And with this one, I just want to sit down and finish it. But The Sea Also Rises is, it's funny because I started writing it like many people who, you know, perhaps were too ignorant to believe that Trump would be elected. And so it's set in this dystopian fiction world where, you know, what if Trump was president and what if he abolishes every single, you know, branch of government? And what if the sea really does rise like astronomically, and Florida is just a series of islands and like there's no fresh water, like how are we helping the people who are kind of left in those ruins? And but it's strange. It's sort of in some ways not quite sci-fi, but it's definitely like, you know, apocalyptic fiction or like adventurous, you know. So it's, you know, the main character is this woman named Talia, and she's just sort of trying to you know, function, and at the same time she's lost her daughter out to sea. And so it's interesting, I guess it kind of has some ties with the Kipper poem in that she hasn't given up hope that her daughter's out there somewhere, but she's also trying to like deliver fresh water and, you know, make sense of this new world and like, you know, 2080, something like that, you know, with where storms are just, they're not just apocalyptic sometimes, they are all the time, you know, and like, what's the new normal post climate change, and we've gone too far and we can't go back.
Right.
And so I think in some ways it was sort of like, you know, a dreary wake up call of like, you know, what if we don't do enough in time? What's the reality going to be, and how are people going to live in it? So, I mean, I know it's a little eerie, but it's fun to write. And it's been a while, so I want to return to it again.
Okay. So it is on the, it's still in the.
Yeah, it's still here.
It's still on the books. Okay, yeah. Cool. Or in the pages.
Right.
Right. I'm now intrigued on that. How you can end it off. And so it's like, oh, okay. I can dig that. So that's basically going to be your, like a young adult fiction, or are you more.
Oh, that's a good question. I feel like there is probably, it could be more marketable as young adult, but I don't know that it would be young adult traditionally. I think it would be more just, you know, just in the apocalyptic, you know, fiction, just fiction in general, okay. Just for anyone. But I think it could definitely, you know, having been and still teaching, you know, high school level, it could definitely, you know, transcend to the audience as well.
Oh, okay. I can work that. And so, coming up is you're going to be having your feature on February 3rd. So what can we expect from your feature? I mean, you don't have to give me the juicy details like I'm going to tell this poem. You've been in and out of the poetry scene.
Mm-hmm.
So coming back in and, you know, getting a little fresher from the slam, am I suspecting going to be more poems coming out of the Chronicles, mm-hmm. or a couple poems that you've been holding up from after you made your first book and stuff, or it's like that?
Well, they're definitely not from the older collection. I've kind of like, you know, set those poems, I'm at peace with those poems, and those are, you know, from the past. A lot, I would say majority of it is from the new collection, if not something I've written recently, very recently. I do have one to share later if you'd like me to. And I think what you can expect is me to be stoic, I suppose, with my stage fright. Because like I said, it's, you know, it's always that first poem that, getting up in front of a crowd of people and looking at them in the eye and being authentically your true self and talking about, you know, what you've gone through. And I think a lot of it is there's so much shame around being brought up around drug addiction or dysfunction that it's sort of like, for me, when I stand up, it's, you know, sort of shaking that off. And I don't know, trying to think of the words, transforming from a place of like shame and not having enough self-esteem to this is my story and this is who I am, and, you know, accept me for who I am. And I accept you for who you are if you also were brought up that way. I think that there's a lot of people don't speak a lot about that, about what it is to be brought up, you know, in the midst of all that, because there is a lot of shame that is connected to that type of upbringing, and the judgment that you face and feel, and feeling like you're different or you're less than groups of people and that type of thing. So, yeah.
Yeah. That's weird that you said that, because I'm, well, not weird that you said that. It's funny that you said that, because what came to my mind is, with a lot of poets now, when they're talking about trauma and stuff, they now speak on their phrase, the biggest phrase that they now use to get people to dig into it or say what they have to say about shame or whatever, say speak your truth.
Yes.
Yeah, they basically speak your truth. And mm-hmm. it's always interesting to me what people assume is their truth, you know, mm-hmm. people, you know, something like drunk, like mm-hmm. alcoholism, drugs, and mm-hmm. Abuse and stuff. And like you said, back in the days, used to be some shame in that. Mm-hmm. You never, you know, this is stuff you don't speak about
because right.
this is, that's, you know, it's either your weakness, the weakness, or mm-hmm. it's the item that you never want to bring out, you know, because you don't want to remember it.
Right.
It's something you want to hide away yourself. So since it's now the mental health issue right now, and people are saying, you know, it's necessary, we need this. It's interesting how you point out that all things from stage fright and everything, you speaking your truth.
Mm-hmm.
You, I think even this audience and stuff, you'll be at home. Because
mm-hmm.
most of them understand where their truth or their mental health is and stuff. And hearing it from somebody else, see, they're, most of them are just going to just praise you. So I don't see it as a problem.
Yeah, no, there's definitely a lot of healing and mm-hmm. in hearing that. And I think a lot of the work that I'm doing now with like what I plan to do my dissertation on is in trauma-informed curriculum and trauma-informed behavioral responses, because what I see as being a displaced and even homeless child, when you don't have the typical like home life and upbringing, a lot of schools just aren't well equipped, and the teachers aren't trained or prepared to know like what that's like. So the expectations are still the same as if you had a mom and a dad and, you know, middle class income or higher, and everything was set up with, you know, format and structure and, you know, even tranquility. And that's just not the case for a lot of children, millions and millions of them, in fact. And so I think with that is writing about curriculum that teaches empathy and how do we deal with anxiety, and not assuming everyone, because all of us have experienced trauma, just some of us to more intense extents. And so with what I plan to do, and also the way that we respond to it is essential. So like if someone's acting, I don't think that we should just suspend or expel, because that just is definitely school to prison pipeline. And a lot of times, you know, intense behavioral outbursts in the classroom are just someone dealing with their pain in a really intense manner. And so that's kind of like in interesting ways, it's brought me, you know, to being able to speak on it and say, you know, yes, I know like a lot of you like went home and you got to sit down and do homework in some kind of way. You had a mother or father or grandparent or somebody who was giving you some kind of structure. But if you came home and drugs were being sold on the table and you had nowhere to go and you didn't feel safe, and you might not have been home that night because you didn't feel safe, like that's a whole different world that I think that we have to unearth and talk about, because a lot of the even the crimes being committed, it's just out of desperation. It's out of lack of resources and it's out of pain.
Right.
And so, yeah.
Wow, you go deep. You definitely go deep. even as a mother and stuff, and you also, and you being married also, I can see how you can understand you, if even from your past, you can see that you want your kids to flourish as much as anybody else's kids. You want them to flourish, even with your students that you teach. You want them to flourish as much as you want your children to flourish and stuff.
Absolutely.
And you see the opportunities and stuff, but you also see that, like you pointed out, teachers are not equipped.
Mm-hmm.
And that's scary to say. I've heard that teachers are not equipped, or they're being hand-tied because they're told not to do. And it's
And I think, too, is just with funding. I mean, we don't have enough funding for mental health professionals in schools. And I've been, you know, blessed to work with Aspire Public Schools, where we had counselors at each campus I worked for in Sacramento. Okay. And in Stockton. I had, you know, close relationship with those counselors and was able to refer youth that needed services. But you have one person who's maybe working with 300 plus people. You know, what does that create? And how can that person really attend to the needs of all those students, the same as being a teacher of 125 students plus? Right. And so I just think there's a lot of talk about crimes and reforming other things. And it's like, you don't really have to invest nearly as much money into that or into like the military system, for example, if you could just, you know, fund more money into schools to make sure that students had curriculum that represented them culturally, that they could connect to, that they were engaged within, that yes, it was holding them accountable to standards, but also wasn't inspiring them,
right,
and was innovative. Because I think a lot of times with I'm not against Common Core, but I think when Common Core standards came into place, a lot of times there was just so much focus on the test that I think that a lot of the inspiration and the arts were unintentionally lost, you know, in kind of the crossfire of like, are they prepared? Are they going to be ready for college? Which is important. But if they're not inspired, and if they aren't, you know, able to adapt and able to innovate, are they going to be ready for the workforce anyway? Is the reality of,
right,
you know, of just our world today.
Right.
So,
because there still is the, as they, I've heard and pointed out, that we're still in the same curriculum as we did back in the 1800s. And it's kind of like, I'm like, wow, that's disturbing.
I mean, I wouldn't say exactly. I hear that a lot and I've read that. I think that there are a lot of teachers doing some really creative things, yes, like project-based learning and, you know, infusing music into their classes and, you know, artistry and videos and engagement. But, you know, yeah, we're still sitting down, you know, typically facing an instructor and asked to be quiet a lot. And so, yeah, I think that we do definitely need to look at, you know, the way that we're engaging our youth. And if we couldn't sit down and as adults and be engaged, then how do we expect a child to, you know, find purpose in it if we don't?
I think that's a weird training. So,
yeah, it is.
And even the, you know, there's now a big thing with the schools and stuff saying about arts and music, and also even now sports,
mm-hmm,
are being now going to be taken out of the schools and stuff because of the funding and stuff. And so it's gone to now to the point where they're not even, you know, they don't want any curriculum in place of necessarily needed. You know, the tests is the curriculums need to be done. This other extra curricular stuff is not necessary right now. And I'm like, well, that's kind of a weird way of looking at things. And I mean, I understand that parents don't want to. The parents want to do so much, but just as much they can, you know, how much they can put into it. They need help,
and right?
Like everything else with life. So.
Yeah, I mean, and even as I think in high school too, I'm like, you know what? I know it seems silly, but I think they even need recess. I think they need time to play. I think they need time to be outside. They need, you know, like even if it's just playing soccer. I know they do during lunch sometimes if they are given the opportunity. But I think that there's not enough time to play and to be creative and, you know, to figure out what inspires them. Because whenever I'm teaching, I was teaching a class this morning. It's how can you get them invested? We were writing a group story and it's like, okay, well, they didn't like their topic. Well, let's start from scratch. Who do you want to write about? You know, what do you want to write about? What's important to you? What's a story that you can commit to and engage with? And so I think that that's like at the forefront is there are a lot of amazing teachers out there who are doing great things, but if schools don't take care of them, they burn out and they leave the career rather shortly because they're just exhausted, you know? And so how do we keep our teachers that are really loving and want the best for students, but can also be mothers and fathers and, you know, and parts of their community and, I don't know, husbands and wives and partners as well? Because I think that that's the other part of it. I've definitely even been on dates with my husband where I'm trying to grade papers. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. That's the reality of it.
I used to live with a teacher. I know
that. So you know.
I saw the circumference of her mind. Her mind just getting exaggerated just from all the work she had to go through. Just
right.
To get these papers done. Not only the papers, but also getting the reviews done and stuff. And like,
right. And you want to do right by your students and you want to give them everything that they need. And so I think it's just... There are amazing teachers out there that want the best. There are amazing schools out there that want the best. It's just the funding, I think, has to be, you know, prioritized. And I think once it is and teachers are paid a fair wage and they're expected a reasonable amount of hours, not 24/7 on call mentally, I think that, you know, we will have changes in the educational system that are needed. You know, it's just about, I guess, a restructuring of perspective. But I did want to share one of the poems, if that's okay. Is that okay? Okay. So this is a poem. It's actually the one I think that you had mentioned earlier. So it's funny because I didn't know that you were thinking about that one that I read at the Hot Poetry in the Park. And it's called Our Way Through. And I'm going to read it. I think it kind of encompasses everything that we've conversated throughout this interview and sort of just like, you know, someone's past, the overcoming of the perspective of it, you know, as well as depression and anxiety.
Our Way Through. I come from attraction, sweat, heroin, and lost souls, but that's only needle deep. I arrived as a wake-up call to the hearing impaired because AC/DC can be deafening when it's cranked up all the way. I came to within walls that were wallpapered in nicotine, with carefully carved ashtrays and people magazines, attached by whiskey and coffee-stained rings like adhesive. They were coasting through life, looking for purpose, in the united way that they loved me dearly, loved me distantly, loved to try to love me. I came from desperation, a room zen-like in pot smoke and Zeppelin, encircling with doses of trance-like makeshift significance of teenage energy and revelry, and a tone of, I'm such a rebel without a clause that states, I have to grow up so that my children will know safety. I come from depression, the kind that's both inherited and picked up along the way, the kind you have to squint to find beneath the perfectionism, beyond the painted face and nails, beyond the busy nature of my mother and myself. I come from anxiety, the kind that's kind of cute that leaves cross legs on still and makes you a really dedicated employee, the kind that's conditioned by praise. But I also come from a more life-altering strand that makes every gunshot in the distance feel like a home invasion in progress, the kind that makes nightfall one part yoga pilgrimage, one part torture, but all parts despair. I live with depression and anxiety, the same kind that my parents used and fought and abandoned and ran their way through, but I don't want to run anymore.
What part inspired that poem? Is this a lot of the news hype and all that?
That particular poem I wrote, I think at the time, to be completely honest, because I think we need to talk openly about it, was when I was struggling a little bit with postpartum depression after my second son was born. Hmm. And it was just, I didn't really... you know, come to terms with it until I had my third and final child, my daughter. Okay. But at that time, it was just like, why am I struggling with these feelings of depression? And I think when I really looked back and in reflection of what I went through and the abuse that I witnessed and the drug abuse that I witnessed and alcoholism that I witnessed, I think it was all about the mismanagement of anxiety and depression. And that's just the experience of so many. When you really look at drug abuse and you really look at, you know, the way that it affects us. And, you know, my older brother actually works in, is a counselor and works with substance abuse patients and things like that. And I think when you come from it, from the perspective of having gone through it yourself or having witnessed it yourself, you understand and are, have a little bit more empathy of, this isn't a person that wants to harm themselves. They're a person that doesn't want to feel that emotion, the pain that anxiety and depression can bring to a person. So,
right. Oh, okay. That's unpacking a lot there, people. We got a lot of layers to unpack on there. But no, that was a wonderful poem and stuff. And is our stuff like, is we're going to be feeling some of that stuff along for that Monday? Or
yeah, definitely. That's maybe a poem I'll open with. I'll be kind of working on memorization. I think with memorization, my thing is, you know, avoiding it because I'm afraid, you know, if I put my full effort into it, then, you know, I'll, what if I forget, you know? So I think this time I'm going to, I think you can look forward to at least 2 memorized poems, maybe more. Oh, and then, you know, the rest I'll probably keep copies just in case. Yeah.
It's not, it's a feature. You don't have to memorize. This is your thing. So you can bring the book and everything. Mm-hmm. You can bring 3-4 books just as long as you have them in the bookmark.
Okay. Right. That could be a problem when you lose your page in front of a stage.
Yeah. Oh, that's, I've seen a few of those people do that. I'm like, oh, are you serious? He's gonna just shuffle through trying to find,
right.
I mean, just find one, okay? Mm-hmm. We're here, yeah, for a while.
Right. Anyone will do.
Just pick the first one, you just pull out, boom, there you go. All right, let's read this. Because we don't need you to be looking around trying to figure out which book, which one's, which page I have. Like, that's a pet peeve.
I hear you.
Most definitely. So for people that are interested in stuff, where can we find you on social media with your work and stuff?
Well, I've kind of like gone back and forth with social media, like hiatuses, but I'm like, I also want to promote my work.
Yes.
So I do have a website, and that's ninalarize.com, and last name is L-A-R-I-E-Z-E. On Instagram, there's also a link through Something Poetic with a K. And so it might be a little bit easier to find, and then the link, it's linked through there. So my book is also on Amazon. It's Activistic. And then hopefully, you know, maybe in the next 6 months or so, I'll have, you know, Chronicles of a Broken Childhood available, and we'll go from there.
Just let people know, Activistic is out of print. So you have to go to Ace Books, or you can get the Kindle version. That's why I get it.
Yeah. So conversation with Amazon today. We are updating it. There's going to be a second edition. And so I'm hoping within the next few weeks or so, we'll have it back up and available for print. Because that's something I just noticed. It was right after, like, I guess 2020, because it was available as of, you know, December of 2019.
Okay.
So getting that updated.
Okay. I just had the Kindle version. So okay. I was a little surprised. Like, oh, the Kindle version is here. Let me read this out. But no, yes, get that book if you can. But you can. But that's just some of her old work. If you want some of the new work, she does have it on her website. Go over there, check it out. Are you on like Facebook or anything?
I am. Yeah, Nina Lurie's, also on Facebook. I have an artist page, and yeah, like a lot of pictures of my children. Really, is what that is.
Yeah. But yeah. No, she's gonna be here, people. On February 3rd with Lynn Geminara, and she's going to have some stuff for you and for this, for SPC over at Sacramento Poetry Center on the February 3rd, 7:30. Please be there. She'll have some merch and everything, and check her out. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate
always. It. But that's all you're going to hear for now from Iambic. We'll talk to y'all later. See ya.